Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefeo on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Once again, I'd like to welcome our listeners to the Socialist Insight. And once again, we have Stephen Katz. He's joining the program as he comes on every other week and discusses a lot of issues relevant to the present state of our government, almost like the State of the Union, but we give a more precise view of what the State of the Union is and how we're affiliating in world affairs. And once again, Stephen, I would like to thank you for joining
the program.
Stephen is joining us today. He is a philosopher. Also, he's an attorney and a political analyst. And, Stephen, we really appreciate you bringing those expertise to our discussion. Stephen, you know, one of the things is you had suggested that you wanted to get into the discussion on national our discussion today, I might mention, is the national security state propaganda,
right,
and the end of constitutional rights. And those,
that's
a pretty big subject. You know, we're going around daily not understanding that the world has completely changed around us from what it was even just within the last 10 years. The world that, at least the world that we thought that we were living in the 50s and the 60s, it's completely a different world. We're living in a global community, and much of what we saw when we were thinking about approaching 1984 and 2000, we're already living in that time now. But, Stephen, as I mentioned, you had suggested that we discuss this, and when we see a national security state, What are we talking about? Could you give our listeners a glimpse at our discussion today?
Well, a national security state is something that really grew up in the era right after World War II, during the Cold War, and of course, countries, you know, have always had intelligence apparatuses and spies, probably going back to the Egyptians. I mean, going back to the rise of class civilizations and armies and wars and conflicts between societies and nations. And national security is really encompasses a whole host of methodologies for waging a secret war against one's perceived enemies or adversaries, be it industrial or political or economic. I could say that of course, in the wake of World War II, with the atomic weapons that were being possessed and so forth, and when the Soviet Union was in existence, but it doesn't originate with World War II. But the importance in the United States is that we have always had constitutional rights here from the inception of the legal structure of the country, and although things have happened along the way, during and after World War II, actually even World War I, it started in executive branch of the government has, under the general rubric of the war power, taken upon itself to decide that they are in an extraordinary situation, and therefore they can pick and choose which laws they will obey and which laws they will enforce. You know, and I'm talking specifically about constitutional provisions, which gives us, including the amendments, which give us our fundamental jurisprudence.
I'm just curious when you say they pick and choose which laws they will they will obey and which laws they will not. I mean, are they not the executive branch? Are they still not bound by the Constitution? They are bound by the Constitution. How can they pick and choose which laws that they will obey and which laws that they will disobey? How is that possible?
Well,
because the law is the law. So if they violate the law, then they're an outlaw. It becomes an outlaw government.
Well, as I've said many times, you know, I consider the capitalist state to be a criminal state. All states, to the extent that they represent ruling elites and are oppressive, are lawless in terms of the fact that they are going to distort whatever exists for the benefit of those who rule, so that... Frederick Engels said a long time ago that you have a state where you have a class society and you have a ruling class, and he defined the state as bodies of armed men. Now, what are bodies of armed men? Well, the police, the army, the courts that enforce the rule and the laws that the ruling elite, which, you know, increasingly is an elite of capitalists in the West,
right,
and in some other parts of the country, and they will, and this is why the anarchists did not want any transitional state after a revolution. They wanted to get rid of it immediately because they were afraid that any kind of state would, in the hands of any kind of group, would become the same thing all over again under a different ideology. And now, what about, you know, now we are, of course, the laws exist, and as the great anarchist Peter Kropotkin said in an essay on law, which was written 100 years ago, that, you know, in the whole history of law, as law has grown up, there's all kinds of laws that are customary and common law, and so on and so forth, which is necessary for life to function, so that people can do their economic transactions, so that people can be protected against, you know, those who are real criminals. I mean, people who would hurt other people or not confiscate their personal property, and so on and so forth. And then he said there were, which he considered legitimate, because you can't have a society unless you have some basic, you know, rules. No matter how much freedom you want to go for, you have to have it within some kind of context. Otherwise, you would just have complete chaos.
Well, if you say on basic rules, I mean, when you have rules in any type of government, and let's consider having rules in the government here in this country, I mean, it seemed like there's no end of the government. This installed government being able to just violate any law that they choose to violate. But I mean, where do we put limitations on, you know, the government being able to violate these laws? I mean, obviously, we have courts, we have the courts all the way to the Supreme Court. Everything is basically rubber stamped in this country now. But where is there any type of, you know, foundation to give, you know, protection to the people of the nation, where, you know, the ones that are violating these laws that are in high office to protect the citizens of that nation? And the reason, and we're going to get into, you know, with this war on terrorism, basically, you know, it's all kinds of violation against the people of this country. And supposedly, it's done all under national security. But where is the protection for the people within any state, especially when we're talking about here in the U.S.? Because I don't see it, Stephen.
No, we don't. We don't have the. We don't have it in certain terms. Now, positive law is law which is created by a state. It's not like common law or natural law, which comes out of the people and, you know, has grown up in history and in societies, you know, so that everyone, you know, knows when they're driving which side of the street to drive on, or when they have economic transactions or their disputes or whatever. But, you know, we're talking about a much larger thing. And I don't think the only thing that was envisioned, really, even in the Civil War of the United States, which was a real war, in the 60s, people say we had a kind of civil war, but we had a lot of civil dissent and a lot of civil unrest, but we didn't have a civil war. We had two armies fighting here, and Abraham Lincoln, who, you know, is, you know, usually considered a pretty revered figure by many people for what he did, and who had many good qualities personally and politically, he suspended the writ of habeas corpus for a period of time during the Civil War. Now, habeas corpus, you know, if a civilian is put in jail, they could file a writ to have their case heard in court, so that the government has to show, you know, why they're there and give justification. They can't just put someone in jail and not give them a hearing or whatever, you know. And now the U.S. Supreme Court said that Lincoln had violated the Constitution by suspending the writ of habeas corpus during the Civil War. And that was a very extreme, in Ex Parte Milligan, and that was a very extreme situation, because you had armies on a battlefield. And they said, no, you can't suspend somebody's constitutional rights like that. Now, what has happened as time has gone on, beginning in the First World War in the United States now and then expanding, is the fact that the definition of war has become more and more elastic, and the executive has the power to enforce laws or to not enforce laws, and to interpret various laws in the course of enforcement. And, you know, for instance, you know, example, one good example is that Eugene Debs in World War One spoke out against the draft and conscription and against World War One. Now, he was put in jail for that, which clear violation of the First Amendment.
Right.
And you know, he was put in jail for that under some sort of espionage act that existed at that time.
Right.
Yeah, that was being used in that way. And, you know, during normal time,
during normal times, what?
During normal time, like if someone made a speech during normal times and was speaking, you know, there was no war or conflict going on, but was just speaking in general, they wouldn't be arrested. But the thing about the First Amendment is the First Amendment protects speech of all kinds except those that are, that have an effect that will cause some kind of imminent action, you know, imminent destructive action.
Let me ask you this, Stephen. What protection do people have under the Constitution today?
It's hard to say, and it depends on the area, but we're more
let's talk about the area of the United States. What protection do
what
people have?
We're in a totalitarian state. And the reason I say that is that we have the protection of the laws that the ruling powers choose to respect. And if they choose not to respect it, then we don't have that protection. And, I mean, the President of the United States, all he has to do now is sit down and designate somebody a terrorist, which is a term, which is a very loose term. All he has to do is sit down and say someone is a terrorist, and they can take that person and you know, deprive them of all constitutional rights and put them in a military prison for the next 100 years.
Okay, let's get to what you're saying, constitutional rights. When I think of a right, I'm thinking of something that's guaranteed to me. That's a right.
Right.
But we have, in the Senate, they're trying to say that all of our constitutional rights, I mean, and this is gaining support in the U.S. Senate, that all of our constitutional rights actually are privileges, not rights. So a privilege is not something that's guaranteed. Like here in California, they say, you know, your right to drive on the streets, your right to a driver's license, it's a privilege. It's not guaranteed. So when you look at, like, your right under the Constitution, if it's a privilege, that's not a right. So explain how would this be, you know, would these be rights under the Constitution, even today, when these rights can easily be taken away from you by just exercising what we believe, like freedom of speech, you know, whether we're, you know, whether it's in regards to what you were talking about, habeas corpus, you know, where if you're arrested, you know, you have some type of rights in the law, but these can easily be snatched from you at any time.
Well, I mean, law exists in the exercise and operation. I mean, you could have law on the books that has been passed, but it has to be put into operation, and that can only happen by the vehicles of government. And those people who control the engines of government will control that. And now, a good judiciary can do a lot to put restraints on that, but the people who usually are in power make sure that the courts are stacked in their favor, which they are. And we have a U.S. Supreme Court today, which is probably one of the most conservative reactionary courts we've had.
Would you call it conservative? I wouldn't call it conservative. I mean, in my opinion, this is just a rubber stamp court. This Supreme Court is like it's completely will rubber stamp anything that comes out of the executive branch. It will rubber stamp anything that comes out of Congress. So, I mean, basically, this whole three-tier governmental system we have, the executive, judicial, and the legislative branch, they're on the same page, you know, and they're taking us in one direction, and it's a different direction from where the people of this country want to go.
They would have to be on the same page to a high degree, because the people who the wealthy, powerful people.
Well, should they be on the same page? I would think when I'm looking at the judicial branch, this should be the branch that is looking for fairness in government. In other words, they're going to look at whatever the laws are of the land, whether it's the national or looking at the laws for the various states, and they're going to make decisions. And this is throughout the history of time. When we think of justice, you're going to make decisions based on what is fair. We don't see that in this country anymore. Stephen?
Well, I mean,
you're an attorney.
Yes,
maybe you can help me out here.
Yes. What I'm pointing out is that theoretically, the basis of this country, they was supposed to be built on a certain amount of checks and balances, as you know, and the judiciary was supposed to be a check on both the Congress, the legislative, and the enforcement aspect in the executive. But when you have a ruling class that's very powerful and can control who gets on the court, who gets into the Congress, and who gets into the executive branch, you know, a lot of it is going to be on the same page. I mean, most of it is going to be on the same page.
Let me just give you some examples of what's taking place in this country, and all of us, everyone listening today, they can see this happening. You see it almost on a, it's on a regular basis that's going on. Anyone taking or making a recording of any police actions, whether they're arresting or whether they pull someone. Just recently, it was a person here in California. He was recording something, and the police, what they did is they went and killed his dog, you know. But the thing is, part of what the problem that the police department saw, what they were looking at, is they arrested him partially because he was recording them and he wasn't doing anything. The individual, the police, once they approached him, then the dog dog responded because, I guess, to protect his master. And subsequently, they killed the dog, you know. But the gentleman, he was still arrested because they say he shouldn't have been recording. But, Stephen, this is happening around the country now. Any type of actions, if the police see that you're recording them, they will come and you will be arrested for that. That's one example. But, and Stephen, I mean, you seem like, to me, you know, maybe I'm naive, but just, you know, where you are using a recording device or observing a police action, I don't see where that's grounds where, you know, the court should be able to stand up for that government and say that you do not have a right to do that. Why shouldn't you have a right? Help me out. You're an attorney.
You do have a right to do that if you're in a public place, and that's, of course, that's also within your rights under the First Amendment, because if you record that, it's like writing an article and publishing it.
Right, exactly.
You know. Yeah, so I mean, and the police, you see, the police will do certain things that they know they really have no firm legal grounds, but they do it, you know, because they know they can do it with impunity, and, you know, the court might slap somebody's wrist here and there, but they do it, you know, they do a lot of things like that, you know, because, you know, they don't want to be sued for something, or they don't want something, you know, they don't want bad publicity, or, you know, so on and so forth.
Well, let's face it. In my opinion, they really need to be recorded. When we see what happened with Oscar Grant, when we see what happened with Kelly Thomas, when we saw what happened with Rodney King, and we could see the importance of recording police actions because they were violating people's rights. And now they said, we don't want you to record what record these violations. But this is just, Stephen, this is just part of the tip of the iceberg. But finish your thought on that, and then I'm gonna go and move on, because we want to look at some of these things in regards to national security. We want to talk about...
Yeah, I was just about to say, the in the area of national security, that is the one area that the state can more or less nullify everything through the War Powers Act and through the fact that I would say the overwhelming majority of the judges, all the government has to do is say the two words national security, and they let them do whatever they want. And they become very, I mean, you know, there were a handful of judges like William O. Douglas that would not put up with that type of stuff, but particularly today, you know, they don't want to be seen as somebody that's, you know, going against the government when the government is trying to protect people or whatever. They get very skittish, you know, when they tell them, you know, that there's classified information and all kinds of things, and jurisdiction, shall we say, that the nexus has grown stronger and stronger. That's exactly what Eisenhower was talking about in his last speech when he was talking about the influences on every aspect of life of the military-industrial complex.
Yeah, right.
But in that whole idea that he was trying to get over, he was talking really about also about the national security state. If you listen to the speech, which has been played from time to time, you know, you can hear him talking about our rights and our liberties are in jeopardy, and he was certainly in a position to know, and you know, but he was one person, and so this has increased over time. Now, when the Soviet Union existed, they had the U.S. state had an ongoing Cold War, and that gave them the ability to use this their national security powers on a continuous basis. But then when the Soviet Union disintegrated, they needed something else to justify it, and lo and behold, they came up with this war on terrorism, which is even better for them because, you know, with the Soviet Union, you had a defined state, you had defined people and policies. But with terrorism, it's an amorphous conspiracy that could exist for thousands of years. So, right. In effect, it allows them to do whatever they want without end, without challenge, from now, you know, indefinitely. You know, because it's a so-called indefinite war. And, of course, it meets none of the criteria of war. If you had a foreign army on U.S. soil, in my opinion, as a legal opinion, that would be the only circumstance that I think some of the things they do might be justified in an active, you know, if the country was invaded,
right.
You know, and it was just the exigencies of emergencies where certain things would have to be done, like in an actual battlefield situation. But, I mean, we're very far from that, and that hasn't happened, I think, since the British invaded Washington in 1812. So, I mean, that's not, you know, that's no, you know, no excuse, you know, to tap everybody's phone in the United States without probable cause or any reason,
right.
You know, to deprive people of due process, to, you know, to do whatever they want under this national security idea. And now, a lot of people, now, this has been going on for a long time. Like during World War II, we had intelligence agencies, military intelligence, but this didn't stop with these classically defined wars. This continued and has now reached the point where I think we live in a state which could very easily transition over to a fully fascist state where the law is simply what the powerful ruling elite believes serves their interest at any one point in time. And
right.
Things have happened and have come out now that more and more, you know, we know, for instance, that the CIA has had foreign leaders deposed, assassinated, and that they've been involved in various so-called black box operations. But then, of course, you know, we've had this, we've had these drone attacks recently, where American citizens have been killed. This guy Iwaki, or whatever, and his son. And other people, and even innocent civilians, but U.S. citizens have been killed now. But what people don't realize is that the CIA, it has now been proven, has murdered John F. Kennedy. I mean, they were intimately involved with the mafia, and all of the evidence has come out. It's been documented by former FBI agents who have undertaken their own investigations, private investigators, and pressed for years. Finally, these documentaries have been produced now that we have CDs, and they're available. One is called I Shot Kennedy, and the actual assassin who's James Files, he's in prison in Illinois, talks about the relationship between the mafia and the CIA. And
right.
There's another tape called Confessions from the Grassy Knoll, which in which you have former CIA contract agents And the whole operation is described. I don't want to go into all the details.
Yeah.
You can see it on those DVDs about how they wanted to that, you know, because of what Kennedy did in not supporting the Bay of Pigs invasion.
And all that's part of this national security state we're
talking
about.
Yeah, that's all
Stephen,
national. Go ahead.
I just want to mention that we do have Stephen Cassie's joining the program once again. We have Stephen. Stephen Cass joined the program every other week, and today we're talking about the national security state propaganda and the end of constitutional rights. And we're going to save a few minutes toward the end of the program to talk about the crisis in East Ukraine, the new line in the sand. Stephen, I'm going to touch on a few things when we're talking about this national security state. Indefinite military detention of U.S. citizens. I mean, this is reality now. I mean, you know, we were in the Matrix, and now we've been released, and now we're looking at the way the world that we were, the dream world that we're living in. I don't know if you've ever seen that movie. It's one of my favorite movies. But the thing is, it reminds me of a reality that we think we're living in here today, but really in the reality of it is this world is so much that is going on behind the scenes that we never see. But when we talk about a security state, here, Stephen, we say indefinite military detention of U.S. citizens. We're not talking about doing a time of war, but we're talking about where now we can say it's a war against terrorism, and we can lock up citizens indefinitely. Where is any time? I mean, if you're talking about a security state, what was worse in Nazi Germany?
Well, I mean,
Indefinite detention.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that you say that because in Nazi Germany, they gave trials to the people who were accused of setting the Reichstag on fire, which many people have analogized to the 9/11 incident here. And they were given regular judicial trials. I'm not saying that they were model trials or fair trials, but they were open trials, and they were in Germany. Well, one guy they did, but they actually acquitted a few people. And,
As news to
they
me.
They did.
Okay.
They did, yes. They acquitted a few people. One person was executed for it, but I know definitely that recollection serves that at least one or more were acquitted. They didn't have the evidence. Now, I ask you, there's no, you know, now they're starting to try some of the 9/11 or Al-Qaeda people in U.S. federal courts, but I have yet to hear of anybody that's been accused of being connected with 9/11 being acquitted of anything. Not only that, but it's a struggle for any of them to get a trial in a federal court. And now down in Guantanamo, there's one guy there that is a complete wreck now, his counsel says. He's been held for 11 years, and the government has admitted that they can't prove he did anything. And they're trying to, you know, they've been trying to arrange to try to get him sent back to wherever it is that that he originates from, and I don't know what difficulties come there, but, you know, that shows you not only no trial, but they left the guy there for 11 years.
Well, what I'm looking at is these senators now, when they drafted this indefinite military detention, the senators and the thinking behind this fiasco was, according to supporters, America is part of a battlefield in the so-called war on terror. You know, the war on terror. I mean, they have taken this war on terror to the nth degree, where, in other words, it's freedom to do anything to violate the rights of citizens. But I mean, and then what you were saying a few minutes ago, I mean, apparently, you know, they created this Al-Qaeda. This is this Al-Qaeda thing is Al-Qaeda, the way Bush always said it, mentioned that. But this is something that's been created by this government so they can, you know, carry out their war on terror. But targeting U.S. citizens for killings, I mean, Steve,
that has happened. And
I mean, Larky, what you were saying, you know, here he was a U.S. citizen, and he was actually killed by an American missile. They targeted him for a killing. I mean,
right. I mean, and increasingly, drones are being used by U.S. police forces within the United States as well as the military, and they're using them for relatively innocent. Some of the purposes that they claim are relatively innocent, but this is tremendously dangerous, and you know, that's something that we have to watch. But you know, basically speaking, look, words have meanings, and there is an objective reality, even though people may see it somewhat slightly differently. But what's happening is they are, for instance, recently the U.S. military got recognition that it was always the case that they were not supposed to be doing overt psychological warfare on the domestic population, but now apparently they got permission to do certain types of domestic propaganda here. But it's always been the case. But what we have now is they've blurred the line between fantasy and reality. And
right.
They have this, so that they're creating basically a reality that serves their purposes but does not really exist. And there's different ways of doing that. And, you know, with all the media that we have today, it's easier than ever before. And to show you sometimes the effects and that can happen, I mean, it's a very it was very famous that that Orson Welles radio broadcast where he pretended to reenact what would happen if there was an extraterrestrial invasion of the United States. And people who didn't catch the original introduction tuned into their radios, panicked because they thought it was actually happening. And that's just one example of what the power of media could be, and that was just totally by accident, and it wasn't thought out well the way they did it, the sense that,
mm-hmm.
you know, people believed it, and they were panicking. They were getting into their cars, and they were driving, you know, they were trying to flee, you know, different areas, and, you know, and nothing was happening, really. Nothing was happening. So, you know, that is a reality that we have to think about. And
Well, here's another one that I want you to just, you know, when we think about journalists, you know, we have journalists out there so that they can be able to present to us the news. I mean, it's spoon-fed
yes.
news that most people see, but it's still news. And usually you can see that over the years they present their identification and, you know, then they are able to collect information, photos, videos, and like that. But here recently during the Occupy movement, they had journalists being arrested all across the country just because they were interviewing individuals in those areas. They were taking photos, videos, and they were more than like four dozen journalists were arrested across the country. I mean, and most of them in New York.
Right. They don't want any other possible source to define the reality. And, you know, they want to be able to have their own narrative and to do their own things, and they don't want to, and increasingly, of course, they treat the domestic population as an enemy. The corporations treat everybody as an enemy, and the capitalists and their state, they treat everybody as an enemy, potentially or really. And, you know, to the extent that they need their labor power do they give them any slack or any phony friendliness. And they don't want, because, for instance, if you were on an actual battlefield, either here or, let's say, some other place during war, there might be some pretty good reason why you wouldn't want people to be taking pictures during, you know, because of military intelligence. I mean, you know, you wouldn't want people taking pictures of certain maneuvers that the Army wanted to keep secret from the other Army, or, you know what I'm saying. But when
right.
you're dealing with your own domestic population, and I was always very suspicious, and I, as a member of the Lawyers Guild, I went down and I did some few days of legal observing at Occupy Wall Street in Lower Manhattan here, and it was felt that with lawyers walking around, you know, at least the police would get a sense that, you know, they would be watched and monitored in terms of, you know, what they were doing. And I was there for several days, despite the fact that at some demonstrations, some of our people were arrested.
Right.
You know, but this was just the encampment. Now, I had somebody approach me the last day that I was down there and started asking me all kinds of questions and claimed to be from a magazine. I said, do you have any press credentials? And they said, no, this is my first day on the job. And they
right.
started asking me, who's behind all this? Who's funding all this? Who's this, that? And I said, listen, if you can't tell me who you are and you don't have any identification credentials and everything, I'm not talking to you. And I just
right.
walked away from them. Now, I don't know who this person was, but I do remember the 1960s. And they had all kinds of agent provocateurs, police agents. I mean, who knows? Who knows who this person was, who they were working for? They could have been working for the CIA. They could have been working for anybody. They could have been hired as a private detective by Wall Street. I mean, I don't know who they were, you know? But,
of the other things I'm looking at is surveillance drones spying on American soil. You know, and I guess one of the things why I'm really concerned about that, I was frequently over the last 7, 8 months to a year, when I go out in my backyard, I was telling my wife, and she said, Stuart, you couldn't be, she said, sweetheart, you couldn't be serious. I say, when I'm out there, I can be out there for 2 hours. I hear this thing just flying over the whole time I'm out there. And
right.
So finally, one day she was out there with me, and for almost 2 hours while we worked in the backyard, you heard this buzzing over. It was at a higher altitude. It wasn't a plane, one of the planes going to the local airports, but it was constantly for almost 2 hours. I don't know. I couldn't see it, but I heard it buzzing over. You know, like when you hear like a light plane buzzing over. But anyway, the point that I'm making, Stephen,
yes.
is that they have surveillance drones that are spying on people in our cities and our neighborhoods across this country,
right, right.
especially with people speaking out, people like you, like Ruth Ann, I mean, like Alan, like Alan Mackey. You are being watched every day. But when we talk about a national security state, Stephen, this fits right into that mold.
Exactly, and it's a one thing that came out of the Reichstag fire is the fact that it was the causative event for Hitler getting passed at the so-called emergency decree, in which he virtually had all powers of the state as the executive. And from that time on until he committed suicide at the bunker in Berlin, he had all the power. and the parliament that existed there was just a rubber stamp, if it even met at all. And he used that as an excuse. And 9/11 has been used similarly as an excuse, without getting into a, we don't have time to get into all the theories about, who staged it, was it staged, was it real, even assuming that, everything that was said about it was real, it was used as, it's been used as an excuse. Now, one thing is, when the domestic population, the first thing you have to do, which they do as a matter of psychological warfare, is frighten people. And once people are frightened, they tend to become submissive, and they let the authorities do whatever they want because they're
right.
scared, and they figure, they need protection, but various things happen, and the rights which people fought for very hard, and that did not exist under feudalism, but did exist after the bourgeois revolutions. The right to due process, the right to courts, the elections. To the extent that people have any input in elections. All of these things are important things. So that people's basic ability to function and live reasonable, satisfactory lives are supposed to be protected. But when you get into crisis situations, all kinds of things happen. And it wasn't focused on very frequently, but during the tragic Boston Marathon incident, when they were chasing down those remaining two guys that they had under that they believe were perpetrators, but that one guy, they not only did they close down the whole city, but they were going house to house, without any warrants or anything. And now there's something in law called exigent circumstances, which means if you see a guy running out of a liquor store with a gun and a bag of cash, you don't have to try to hunt down a judge to get a warrant, to chase him and to search his car, because if you have to do that, by the time you do that, the guy is gone. Now that's
right.
But if you extrapolate that to a whole city, that loses all meaning. Now,
right.
If you want to go into everybody's house for, a 35-mile area, you need warrants. You need something to show that you think that your suspect is there or is being harbored there or whatever. Now, if you chase him into a house, that's a different story. But that's not the case here. I mean, they did finally come up with this guy, and I think they did that by virtue of aerial surveillance and some other things. That's okay, in the sense that they weren't, they weren't intruding in anyone's house and searching things and doing stuff. But that was something that, they could do in public, through their normal surveillance and everything else. But that's just another example of what I'm talking about.
We're going to talk a little bit about propaganda because we want to show how this fits in the national security state.
Right, and
then
right.
We're going to touch off just at the very end on what's going on in the Ukraine. Once again,
right.
We have Stephen Katz. He's joining us on the program. Stephen Katz joins the program every other week. Comes on with a lot of food for thought in regards to things that you don't hear on the spoon-fed news, and also that you would normally hear see in your newspapers or hear from government officials. And today we're talking about the national security state,
right.
Propaganda, and the end of constitutional rights. And for the most part, the end of constitutional rights, that's already happened. The national security state That's right. Already happened. The propaganda is already happening. When you turn on television, whether it's morning, noon, or afternoon, you have garbage programming, garbage in, garbage out. So that's all that they're instructed to present to the public, and then you receive garbage. In the morning, every 15 minutes to 30 minutes, they're giving you the same garbage. The news, if you want to look at it, even the national news is so focused on local issues. They don't let you know what is going on an international level. Just recently, it was a Malaysian airliner that had crashed. Here we have some severe events that were going over in the Ukraine. A government that had been seized and overthrown, backed by this government, the government that overthrew the existing government, it was backed by this government. Here, the whole nation, while much of this was still unfolding, and we were moving into a de facto state of war with Russia. Here, we're focusing on a lot of local issues and what's going on with an aircraft that has been down somewhere in the world, become lost on the screen. But, Stephen, when we talk about in this national security state, there's a lot of emphasis now being placed on the government making certain that these government-controlled news media is giving us more so than ever spoon-fed news. Could you talk about how propaganda fits in this? And I might mention last year the government repealed the propaganda ban, where now they can give spoon-fed news 24/7. But how does propaganda fit into this national security state?
Well, I mean, when you have a society that largely benefits the ruling class, which is always the case where you have a state, you have to make the situation seem legitimate in the eyes of the masses of people whose lives are being exploited one way or another. And in the Middle Ages, they did it by the divine right of kings. They misused, you know, religious and spiritual beliefs, you know, to say that this is, you know, the way God wants it, you know. Now, there's two basic ways for the ruling classes of any state, be they communist party rulers or capitalists or what have you. And one is you have to somehow secure the consent population to do what the rulers want them to do. And one thing you have to do is maintain the legitimacy of the state in the eyes of the people subjected to it. In other words, they have to accept it as somehow being in their benefit or being legitimate or being something that should be there and that has a reason to be there and, you know, is something they need to support. The second line of defense, of course, if that breaks down, then the military comes out, the police, the tanks, the drones,
right.
and then it's raw force. Now, of course, in the modern world, in the ancient world and in the medieval times and so on, you know, the force was resorted to more and more, and, you know, they didn't care as much about it. They, you know, they used this just to terrorize the population. Now, in the modern state, you have what I call this mass mind control through the media and through various propaganda outlets to make people believe that the rulers are ruling in their interests when they're not, in you know, for the most part. And, you know, that is the function of a domestic propaganda. Now, television today has become, the news is really not the news anymore. It's more entertainment. And,
oh, it's all entertainment.
It's all entertainment. There's very little that's critical in it. And, I mean, you and I both are old enough to remember back in the 1960s how the journalists reported on Vietnam and the kind of reports we got out of there, which you know, and how the journalists, they were not embedded, so-called, with U.S. troops although they did, of course, talk to the U.S. troops and so on and so forth. But they were able to go out and actually, you know, interview people, the Viet Cong. They were able to go all over the place, and
they were able to interview both sides.
Right. They interviewed both sides. They got into various different places. They did not allow they were giving us some information that upon which the public could begin to make an evaluation. It was skewed somewhat, but at least there was some reality filtering through. Now you see the wars, and you only get what the Pentagon briefings want people to understand.
Yeah, the Pentagon give a briefing and say, this is what you can say what's going on internationally. Stephen, I have like around three more minutes before I want you to give some closing information how people can reach you. Give us an update on what's going on in the Ukraine. People don't understand that we're already in the de facto state of war with Russia. The U.S., NATO, the EU, the European Union, they're pushing the envelope. They have used this crony government to push Russia to the nth degree. But we're already in a de facto state of war. We're already lining up troops on both sides of the border, on the east and the west. But give us an update on what's going on in the beginning stages of this war that you won't hear on public television.
Well, what's happened is, the U.S. and the CIA was responsible for played a big hand in stirring up and supporting and arming the fascist militias that overthrew the legitimate government in the Ukraine. And now we have Blackwater, that people who have followed the Iraq and Afghanistan struggles knows Blackwater is a mercenary group of contractors that are highly trained military men. They're in there trying to deal with the people in the country that don't want to accept an imposed fascist regime. And
I might mention the majority of the people in the Ukraine are objecting to this newly installed government. The majority.
Of course. There's no legitimacy whatsoever.
There's nothing democratic about this at all. This was a complete takeover of a government.
It's a takeover of a government, and it's done under enormous hypocrisy, considering the fact of how many nations the U.S. has invaded who are not only near the U.S. or on their borders, but thousands of miles away, deposed, governments, invaded places and everything. And Russia, is having been invaded many times and having had, their own struggle with fascism, they're quite concerned about it. And now, there's the people in the eastern Ukraine there, the Russians in particular, but it's a highly industrialized area for the country, and, they want to do what Crimea did. And the latest that I hear is that due to the fact that nobody wants World War III to start, consciously at least, and the powers involved have their own agendas, but, they want to, I think what the Russians are pushing now is they want to have some sort of more autonomy for those areas in the eastern Ukraine so they can govern themselves without formally, joining Russia.
And Stephen, I have around another 1 minute.
Right.
Could you give just 30 seconds of what direction is this going? I mean, is the U.S. and NATO and the U.N. going to back down, or are they going to keep pushing the envelope on this?
I think they're pushing the envelope for many different reasons. And
they're going to keep pushing the envelope. How can people reach you? I have 30 seconds. How can people reach you?
I can be reached on Facebook, and I can be reached on LinkedIn.
Steve, I really appreciate you joining the program. You always bring so much information that we can digest over the next 2 weeks.
It's a pleasure.
Stephen, we'll be looking forward to having you to join us again on the Socialist Insight. Thanks again, Ruth Ann.
I look forward to it.
Thanks, our listeners.
Thank you.
We'll see you in 2 weeks. Have a good night.
Good night.
Thank you. Good night.